Balance your trading strategy by adding futures. CME Group helps you manage risk and capture opportunities in all market environments. Capitalize on around-the-clock access to highly liquid global futures and options market across all major asset classes. Just visit your online broker and get started. Plug into valuable educational materials and trading tools and see what adding futures can do for you at cmegroup.com/onthetape. Coast, 1 p.m., 25th of March, the last Monday of the month, the last week of the month, which means, Dan, January, February, March 3, last week of the quarter. So a lot of strange and odd things can happen without question. And I want you folks just to have Stevie Nicks in your head before we get started. Dan, how are you?
I'm doing great. Is it going to be a breakup conversation? Is that what we're going to do here? I went down this rabbit hole with Fleetwood Mac, I think because you had mentioned him probably on Fast Money last week. And you know, like you're sitting in bed and you're just reading a little bit and you caught some, and I didn't realize they all kind of dated each other. And then they wrote up songs about each other. And then they were on the cover of Rolling Stone together. And there was a lot of hidden meanings in that cover. And you get me. You feel me a little bit here, guys?
100%. I mean, yeah. Chris, what people don't realize, and now we're obviously, Amanda's like, oh my God, it's on a Monday, the first 2 minutes, you got to do this. But yeah. Christine McVie, sort of the backbone of that band, songwriter, singer, keyboardist. Yeah. When she passed away, I think Stevie Nicks said, and I think the rest of the band members as well, they will no longer tour as Fleetwood Mac, but she was married to John McVie.
Correct.
Fleetwood Mac would be Mick Fleetwood, the Fleetwood of Fleetwood Mac, and Mac, the Mac of John McVie. Anyway, sorry about that.
How about that?
Well, a little history lesson for you folks.
Yeah. So you and I got a lot of stuff to do this week. A holiday shortened week, by the way. I love a holiday shortened week. Okay. So Thursday is really kind of like Friday here, right? So that's what's happening here. So let's talk about this. I mean, the likelihood, you know, we've discussed a little bit about, you know, the S&P and the NASDAQ kind of like lockstep. That's not something we've seen year to date. You know what I mean? We've seen the NASDAQ, definitely the NASDAQ 100 outperforming the S&P 500. The biggest component to the S&P 500 or a bigger component of the NASDAQ 100. But they're a lockstep here, guy. And this to me is just interesting. And we're going to hit on small caps and we'll hit on some other sectors here a little bit. But it says to me that there's a narrowing of the narrowing in the market. Does that make some sense to you a little bit here? You know what I mean? Because it seems like the rally in the semis, which had been driving a large portion of the broader market rally, is actually narrowing within the semis too.
Yeah, it's interesting. And we'll talk about that. And I agree with you. And it was happening earlier without question when AMD was down around 172 or so earlier today. You know, that appeared the narrowing within the semis was taking place because obviously NVIDIA is still on its horse, but very quietly, AMD's down at one point, at least earlier today, about 23%. From that peak we made, I think on March 8th or thereabout. And we actually put that on our Insta and you can follow us on the Instagram. So I think your point is well taken and we'll see what that means. If anything, I mean, clearly the broader market has not been all that concerned. Although, you know, last week at the end of the week, we sort of saw some signs of weakness. We're seeing it a little around the edges today. We shall see. But before we even get to that, let's take a look at our rundown because I mentioned the great Stevie Nicks and people will be like, all right, what are you effing talking about? What happens after the melt-up? Well, it reminds me of one of the songs off of Belladonna, After the Glitter Fades. So what happens after the glitter fades and what happens after the melt-up? Listen to the song if you want to know what happens. Small caps, breakout or breakdown, energy boost. And you know what? Because we get questions every day, we'll take a couple questions today if time permits.
Yeah, matter oh fact, when glitter fades.
After the glitter fades.
Yeah.
What she's saying is, you know, she gets it. Like when you're a rock star and all this shit's happening, but what happens after the glitter fades?
Well, listen, I just got an update, guy, from the Ticketmaster. She's still touring after all these years, man.
As a solo artist.
She joined that band in like 1975. I actually could go through the whole show. All right, let's do it here. What do you want to start with here, guy? Because
let's look at the S. I mean, it's a futures day, so let's take a look at the S&P, at the E-mini futures, just to sort of see where we are. I mean, again, it's seemingly we do this every day, which we do, but this trend line is still intact. Lower left, upper right, since late October, early November, in place without question. We've tested it a couple times, have not broached it. You know, let's see again. I mean, quarter end, as I mentioned, strange things happen. We'll see how this continues to perform. We've shown you the channel that this is in. We probably have a chart later on in the show, but this is a good place to start, Dan Nathan.
Well, listen, you know what's an even like more fascinating thing to talk about? It's like, so all those folks, you said, you guys, will you stop with the MAG 7?
Stop
with the concentration? Will you stop with the MAGA? That was 4 years ago, the Microsoft, the Apple, the Google, the Amazon. What's really interesting, guy, is that 3 months ago, the largest market cap company in the U.S. was Apple. Okay, it was over $3 trillion. Right now, it has, I think, a $2.6 trillion market cap. It's down 11% or so on the year. And NVIDIA, which is up 93% on the year, now has nearly a $2.4 trillion market cap. So for all those folks, including myself, who thought that if Apple were to start to underperform, you know what I mean, you might find some other mega cap tech stocks kind of join the party a little bit. Well, that hasn't been the case. And then you've had an NVIDIA just gain, you know, look at that, 12 months, 256%. So think about that. Just do the math. It's a $2.4 trillion market cap company. It's made, that's not normal though, guy. Can you agree on that? It's like, that's not a normal occurrence where you will have some stock come from nowhere and more than make up for the market cap losses on a relative basis of one of the biggest leaders. It's just, that's what's kind of unheard of right here.
Cam, when you say out of nowhere, I mean, literally, well, it's not that it's out of complete nowhere, because people were talking about NVIDIA, you know, probably 5 or 6 years ago, definitely pre-COVID for sure. And I actually remember, I think it was in October when Governor Murphy had just been elected. We had this huge snowstorm in the area. I was not able to get to the set of Fast Money. I only remember that because A, it was ridiculous. And B, NVIDIA reported that day and the stock sold off about 25 or 30%. So it was a name we were talking about in earnest for a while. But to your point about seemingly coming out of nowhere, without question, you know, this was not a stock that anybody sort of had AI circled around. It was a graphics chip maker that seemingly had lost their way. And you go back a few Octobers ago, you couldn't give this stock away when it's trading 108. A lot has changed since. But to answer your very specific question about, is there anything normal about a company? It's very normal for a $100 million company to have parabolic moves. When you're talking about trillions of dollars, I mean, I don't think, well, let's put it this way. We've never seen it before. And I think it's anything but normal. And I will continue to say, and some people pushed back on me last week, you know, that three Fridays ago, that reversal has not been broached. Now it's being challenged in terms of today's price action, but that is still intact.
Yeah. Hey, listen, you know, like depending upon how you draw the lines and do the chart, it looks like it's been a nice little base since then. And could that be the launching pad for another move higher? Sure. I mean, like that, I guess, like, just to put, you know, too fine a point on it, sorry, people, is that, again, we've never seen this sort of stuff before. So have fun with it. Enjoy it while it lasts. It's not likely to go from 1,000 down to 500, you know, in one clip or anything like that. So if you're long and you think it's still going to work and this and that, whatever, just be disciplined. That's all we're saying. Because again, through our experience that, you know, a lot of investors make a lot of mistakes at tops. You don't know that they're a top or at bottoms, right? And it's really hard to get back in these stories and that sort of thing. So again, you know, to your point about AMD, guy, and the reversal, maybe they can show the intraday reversal here. The headline this morning, and when you and I were chatting at 9:30, the headline was AMD and Intel down 4% on, you know, new rules out of China about what US chips are going to be able to go into government owned servers and the like in China. And so look at that huge gap, 4%, not, you know, not a small market cap company. It's made it all back, filling that gap. Intel, the same thing. At its lows, down 23, 24% from those March 8th highs. Intel, guy, also down 21% at its lows this morning. So I guess the point is a couple of the other large market cap companies in the semi space have not been participating over the last month, month and a half or so. And then another one, which is not a small name either, which is the Broadcom, which had a big gap after their earnings a week and a half ago or two, and has since filled in a bunch of that gap. But to me, again, it just speaks to the narrowing of the narrowing a little bit, guy.
So it's interesting that we've got AMD is probably unchanged on the day. But to your point about what got us there, it's interesting that this U.S.-China rhetoric continues, at least through my lens, continues to be sort of ratcheted up. And one has to wonder how this ends. You know, again, it's not had any impact whatsoever on the broader market, but things seemingly are getting worse, not better. And, you know, it's manifesting itself around the edges on some individual names and the market shrugs it off. But my concern has been for a long time, an unfounded concern that, you know, U.S. the deterioration of U.S.-China relationships and the potential, obviously, for U.S.-Taiwan situation to continue to escalate, that is not priced in whatsoever in the market. There's no denying that is not priced in.
Yeah, I want to make one other point. It's interesting. So I was looking out at AMD and the chart that they just threw up there. And again, this 180 level is kind of interesting because we've been on kind of either side of it, right? You see that huge breakout about a month and a half ago. And then we pulled back to that level. And you could just look at that and eyeball that and say, okay, well, maybe it consolidates between 175 and 182 or something like that. That'd be a good level. Company expected to report, I think, on May 2nd or so. And I look at this and I go to the options market guy and I look at the May 3rd weekly expiration. And I look at the 180 calls. Okay, they're about $13.50 or so. You can do the math. On a $180 strike, you know, it's about 7.5%. That doesn't seem that crazy, but if you look at the implied move, and how do we figure out the implied move between now and May 3rd? We take the call premium at the 180 strike, and we take the put premium, which is about 12 and a half or so dollars, right? You can do that math there. You're getting to about $26, right? Divided by 180, and that gives you a 14.5% implied move in either direction that is going to incorporate their earnings. So the options market is not making it cheap to play by any means, even with a VIX at 13 and a level of complacency that I think you and I would both agree for the broader market seems there. But that's why we highlight the fact that look at the volatility you've just seen in a stock like this, meant to be a beneficiary, not keeping pace with the market leader, that sort of thing, doesn't have the products and services. You mentioned a bunch of times, this company reported on January 31, they did not beat meaningfully. They did not guide in a way that was commensurate with the sort of breakout that we saw from 180 to 210 or whatever the heck that was. You know what I mean? So again, this is where stock picking, I think, becomes really important, and how you choose to express those views is going to become increasingly more important as we get longer in the tooth in this kind of AI rally.
No, and your point is well taken that the volatility is finding itself in individual names has not made its way into the broader market at all, but we can. And people say you're cherry picking, and it's true to a point, but these are not small companies that we're talking about when you have moves of these magnitudes, up and down, by the way, right? So the volatility is clearly there in these larger names on an individual stock basis, but for whatever reason, the broader market seems to discount the entire thing. The question I guess one has to ask is, I guess one, why, and I can't answer that, but I think the more question is how long will that last before, you know, volatility does find its way into the broader market.
All right, so let me ask you a question. It's a trading question, okay? So let's just say AMD, let's pull that chart up there again, okay? Let's like a 1 year or something. So it's pulled back to this kind of 180 level. That was the level that it broke out when it had that huge day. It was the last day of February, the 29th, right? You see that big up day, it was a new all-time high, and then kept on going. Would you rather right now, if you were bullish on AMD, okay, and you thought they were going to put up a big quarter and a big guide, and let's assume that it's May 2nd, that's the confirmed date. I think it's tentative right now. Would you rather buy the stock right here at $180, or would you rather buy the May 3rd expiration weekly, okay, 180 call, let's say for $13, for, you know, 7% or something like that? What would you rather do right now?
So you obviously the leverage and options works for you on your behalf. I mean, but the, you know, the erosion over time works against you as well. And the flip side of that coin is, you know, you long the stock here, you know, the right level to stop out is probably either today's low or sort of that 168 level. I think that was the price the day they reported on the 31st. But I'll answer your question specifically. I think you're going to get more if you're right, if your directional bet is right, you're going to get more bang out of your buck being long the options, I believe.
Yeah, but your point about the decay, I mean, if it was going to sit here in a consignment.
That's right.
The reason I wanted to use this as an example is like if you're buying the stock here, then you have to think about what do you think your downside is between now and the next month. And that's why figuring out the implied movement in the options market can be really helpful because that's what dealers are expecting, about a 14.5% move in either direction. So if you expected, all right, so down, let's say 10% would be $18, right? Down 14% would be down 24 or whatever, you know what I mean? That sort of thing. That's what the, you know, that's what, you know, the options market is suggesting. And then if you were just to sit on those calls on a 13 VIX for the broad market, and let's say things do just simmer and they go sideways, you're going to be losing money every day.
Every
so
day.
Again, you just have to reevaluate what you think the risk reward, and you might as well just wait until earnings if you're just trying to play it for that event, except unless you thought, you know, expectation of a run-up.
Theta bleed, as they say.
Well, there you go.
But that's the conversation, right? And that's what people struggle with, and that's what they try to figure out. You know, there's a longevity to being long in underlying stock without question. You don't erode, but obviously, you know, you don't get the same leverage that options provide. The flip side of the coin is, you know, if things were just to move sideways, you know, each day sort of erode away that option premium. So it's a tough game. Listen, being right directionally in options when you're right, it's huge. Of course, the timing of these things are what's so critical.
All right. Well, here's one. Let's look at the NASDAQ 100, the E-mini futures here, okay, or the mini futures here. So this is interesting to me, okay, guys? So we talked about this in a few occasions on Market Call over the last week or two that, you know, any given day, sometimes it looks like the NASDAQ 100 futures are up. Up less than the S&P, and that's not something we've seen too frequently. Let's pull up this chart real quickly here, because this thing looks like it's been consolidating. It looks like it's a 45-ish degree angle, you know what I mean, off those October lows. That's what we've basically seen. Look at that 200-day moving average, the way that's moving up. It's the same slope, right? But this thing looks like it's also consolidated a bit in and around that kind of 18,000, if we want to pull it a little tighter too, you know what I mean? And so, you know, might it be setting up for, you know, like another move higher? You know, when you just kind of look at the midpoint, or you look at the closes, right? You see where those closes are, you get a sense for, this feels like a bit of a consolidation. So the question is the NASDAQ 100, which is really dominated right now by obviously NVIDIA, Microsoft, Google, Amazon, Meta, you know what I mean? Is it about to take another leg higher? You know, we're getting to quarter end. We're going to have earnings. I guess Netflix is usually like, it's going to be middle of the month. And then towards the end of the month, we're going to have the cluster of all the bigger names. You know, like the question is, you know, what is the thing, guy, that would cause investors, you know, to get a little nervous about a lot of these names that have come a long way in a short period of time?
Wow. What would get them nervous? You know, I think the headlines that we saw today, I believe, I mean, that's just sort of the tip of the iceberg.
The China but stuff, you think?
US, China, yes. I mean, those chip wars that are seemingly continue to go on, that made people nervous for about an hour today. But to answer your question, you know, an escalation of that, I think, would get people nervous. But short of that this week, you know, I think you're going to see, I mean, history suggests in the absence of news, you know, the markup and the melt up in the quarters is typically something that happens, and I don't think it'll be any different now. So it would not surprise me to see this continue. But what I will say is, you know, at some point, fundamentals do matter and technicals do matter. And I still go back to those three Fridays ago, that reversal is still in place. So I don't know if I answered your question, but that's what is sort of that day to me is concerning. That three Fridays ago is concerned.
All right. And so what I think is really important about your answer to that, guy, on that day, on March 8th, there was nothing fundamental. It was basically, you know, one seller went for the door in NVIDIA, then a couple sellers came in, then they started selling the SMCI, and then they started selling Broadcom. And then so it was a bit of a snowball effect. The one thing I say, if they could draw a quick little uptrend on these E-mini futures here on the NASDAQ, you know, listen, if you're long and you're looking like, you know, if you think this thing could break out or something like that, you know, it's pretty easy. You just said it, you know, you like use the technicals as your friend in a way. You know, that uptrend is like 18,180 or something like that, guy. You know what I mean? So if you're probing this and you're trying to use the futures to play for a breakout, if you see on a near-term basis a consolidation, you know what I mean, above that uptrend, and you see a little what you think is a sideways sort of action, you know what I mean? You're going to want to like stop it though at that uptrend, because at some point, sometimes it's just technicals, right? It's just a sentiment shift, and technicals could cause that thing to go lower. And as that 200 day is working higher, you know what I mean? Sooner or later on a pullback, you're going to get a convergence of that. And you want to make sure you're stopped at certain levels that make sense. And that uptrend makes perfect sense if you are long the NASDAQ E-mini futures.
You know, I hope this is not lost on our audience, but I'll effort an explanation of something. Typically we associate stops with losses, because the two go hand in hand. Stop loss, right? You have a, you're long a stock, you put a stop loss lower, and you get out of a bad position. So stops 90% of the time are associated with getting out of a position and losing. You can also stop into a position. And now I'm getting a little ahead of myself, but you know what you could say is, you know, you want to put a sell stop or a sell order based on that trend line. So you're selling something into a trend line. And I know that's sort of, you know, higher level stuff, but we used to, you know, sell stop of, you know, you're not long it, but you want to get short something on the break of this trend line. And with each passing day, that trend line, that level gets higher and higher. So if we were just to go sideways for the next couple of weeks, that sideways action would actually break the uptrend line, and you can sell stop into a short position, especially with futures. I mean, that's probably for another show, a little higher level shit, but I thought I'd mention it.
That's some good stuff. All right, I want to pull this up. This was a story, I think it was in Bloomberg, and we'll put it in the show notes here. So Ed Yardeni, a lot of folks, you know, kind of label Ed, and, you know, we've had him on our pods before. I really like him, like his work, smart guy. You know, this was a note, and I think it's interesting. Stocks, stock bulls backed by Fed, showing risk of a bubble, and so. But he also warns Guy that, you know, bubbles, when they inflate and they get over exuberant, and like when they pop, they go the other way too. And you know, that's something that you and I have, you know, reminded our listeners, our viewers, and we probably still have a little PTSD from different periods, and you know, just the way things overshoot, and as good as they feel when you're enjoying the inflation of a bubble, when they go the opposite way, it's just nasty. And think about 2022. Like, that was also one where that was like a low vol bear market. It was just kind of every rally, meaningful rally, and there were some big ones, you know what I mean? There was some 18-19%, they got sold, you know what I mean? And but you know, again, you know, they kind of bottomed out at some point, and that was usually a sentiment sort of thing. So talk to me about this, because is it interesting? You know, I know a lot of folks I see in my messages, people saying, all right, when Dan goes bullish, that's kind of going to be the top. You know, when you have guys like this who've ridden this bull run here, when they're saying, you know, maybe it's time to be a little cautious, because that's what I take away from this guy.
Well, I mean, think about it. He's been right. And he's not, I know you know this, but it's important to point out. I mean, he's been bullish. He's been right. I mean, there have been times in history where he's not. So we all get labeled, and that's fine. Your point about 2022, it was a low vol. The only it's interesting, the times of volatility did speak in 2022 were the two times that he had to buy the market. It happened in June of that year, and it happened again in October of that year, and we actually highlighted it both times. 2022 was a year that actually did make sense to me. But to go back to Ed Yardeni's note or point, or what he's saying is, you know, melt-ups are great when you're long things, but melt-ups lead to sort of meltdowns. And again, I think you saw glimpses of that a couple weeks ago. And when the market then subsequently shrugs it off over the next couple days, people say, ah, it wasn't a big deal. See, but you're getting a glimpse as to what could possibly happen and what that could potentially turn into for the broader market.
Yeah, and you know, one thing that Liz Young highlighted to us this morning as we were recording the On the Tape podcast, just a quick point, is that just some of like what she's seeing where utilities, consumer staples, some defensive sectors are starting to act pretty well here. So just the money moving into defensives, might it just be a broadening out, or is it a move to be a bit more defensive, which brings me back to that NASDAQ versus the S&P kind of at similar percentages up on the year. So that's just something to kind of keep an eye on. The other thing is, and this is our little breakout or breakdown segment, you'd also like to see the small caps in the form of the Russell 2000 confirm those all-time highs that we saw in the S&P and the NASDAQ last year, despite this thing still being 15 or 16% from its all-time highs from November 2021. Talking about this chart here, again, it's just kind of grinding. It's held that uptrend. You see the move off the lows there. And then on a five-year basis, this is a level or a range that you've talked about a lot, Guy. I mean, it's been volatile. We've kind of established a new range above those highs that we saw throughout the, you know, a good part of 2023 and earlier this year, but we haven't broken out yet.
I don't know what to make of this. I mean, I'll tell you, obviously one would think that if small caps are finally able to participate through the lens of obviously the futures here, or if you're an equity through the IWM, whatever you look at, that would be constructive for the broader market. That would be the final piece to the puzzle. Okay, small caps are finally participating. That's backing up or galvanizing or whatever word you want to use, the broader market strength. I get it. There's also a school of thought that could potentially say, you know what, if the broader market moves, in other words, technology specifically, but then the broader market sells off in a meaningful way, the flight to quality can, you know, counterintuitively might be in the form of small caps, which people might view as value plays in a falling market. So there's a, I think there's a 50-50 chance that if broadcast, if small caps move higher, the broader market cooperates and does the same, or it could be a flight to perceived safety in the form of small caps as the broader market selling off is looking, people are looking to get out of high value valuation names into names they can wrap their head around. I don't know what to make of it. I'll say this though, if you go back to that chart with the box, we are clearly at the upper end of this band in terms of resistance. It's going to be fascinating to see what happens either way.
Yeah, let's pull up the KRE. This is the S&P Regional Banking Index, and this is one that's kind of interesting. We know that there's in the Russell 2000, there's a bunch of small cap sort of banks too. And the KRE is interesting to me, Guy, because, you know, late last year when the market was breaking out in December, if you look at a one-year chart really quickly, it had that huge big up day. It was December 13th. It was the Fed presser when, mm-hmm. you know, it was dovish and people were pricing in six cuts this year as all systems go. It's interesting. The next day, Guy, the next day it gapped up and that was it. And it's been, you know, just kind of a in a bit of a downtrend and hasn't really been able to get out of its own way. I think that's really interesting. I'm not just trying to find things that kind of confirm my hope that we have a 10% pullback, that sort of thing a little bit, but this would be one of them. And the lack of the Russell, I think, to kind of make establish a new range or make a run back towards its all-time highs, that's another one too.
Yeah, 100% agree. I mean, small and regional banks, I think what we saw there in the absence of bad news, those things sort of levitated. And to your point, when you got that Fed presser that everybody interpreted as dovish, that was sort of the next catalyst. But again, longer term charts suggest that they're really in no man's land here. And, you know, personally, I still think there's sort more pain to come on the small and the regional bank front. And that's going to manifest itself in the KRE trading lower. So we'll see. I think the moving average, I want to say, is like 46 or something-ish. That's a level to keep an eye on. I think we're trading 48.75 now.
Yeah, and again, both of these groups are obviously very sensitive to rates. And it's interesting. Let's pull up the 10-year U.S. Treasury yield, because last week, I think we probably said this four times on Market Call. Okay, so the 10-year on either side of 4.3%. Now this week, we're saying either side of 4.2%, right? Like, you know, like there's been some downward pressure. You can see it. It got up to that kind of, what was that, 4.35 or so, Guy? And, you know, you could say that's a little bit of resistance. It was the prior high from about a month ago. We're sitting right on that 200-day moving average. You see that little uptrend that it's been in a little bit. So you see the levels there, right, to the upside, and you see the level to the downside. And maybe we're just stuck for a little bit, but sooner or later, it will resolve itself. We will have a break one way or another. And so, you know, thoughts on yields and what they mean for stocks right now, because I've seen no shortage of sectors that are now, at least some investors are just making all sorts of arguments, twisting themselves in a pretzel, why yields right here are great no matter what happens. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that is the sweet spot of yields. If yields sort of stay somewhere between, I guess, I don't know, 4% and 4.5%, I'm putting a big range, but you know, that'll be okay. You can have volatility within that band. As long as it stays in it, that's fine for equities. And maybe that is true. I mean, quite frankly, equities of like just about any interest rate environment, you know, short of a couple weeks here and there. What do I think about yields? Well, again, you know, I'm probably one of the few people out there that still think yields go higher for the wrong reasons. And I don't think that'll be equity friendly. But if yields move significantly lower from here, again, what is that signifying? Did something break? Is there market slowdown in the economy? What is lower yields in a meaningful way signifying? And when I say meaningful way, I guess maybe below 3.8% or so on the downside. So I think your point is well taken. I think there is an argument that, you know, in this band, we're fine.
Yeah.
But I think they're telling, again, you know, I still don't think the inflation dragon's been tamed by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, and again, that's why we're going to, volatility could likely pick up if we start seeing, I know PCE's on Friday, we start seeing, you know, a string of inflationary data that looks a little hot. Let's look at the CME Fed Funds tracker here. We're looking at the May meeting, Guy. That's the next one. If we think about this and you see that, it's just a, you know, near 0% chance of a cut. Let's go look at June for a second here. This one's been moving around a little bit, Guy. And, you know, I know that the Atlanta Fed Chair Bostic is speaking, sometime this week. And I think he was quoted on Friday saying he thinks there's only going to be one cut this year, which speaks to kind of the narrative that you're speaking about. I think he wants to, make sure, hold out. The economy is fine right now, right? Like, hold out and make sure that nothing that they do will cause inflation to kind of pick up again. But here we are, about 63% chance of a cut at the June meeting of 25 basis points.
Yeah, I mean, that's, again, I'm sort of in the Bostic camp. I don't see what this, if you look at everything through the lens of the indicators they look at, there's no real compelling reason to really have to lower rates at this point. Like, autopilot to me sort of staying pat makes a lot of sense, especially given all the, you have a lot of basically data that's conflicting right now. And in the midst of conflicting data, why do you have to do anything? Because then you're going to tip the scales, let the data sort of sort itself out, then move accordingly on the back of it. I mean, I'm sure there's still some people out there that wouldn't admit it, that think we probably should still have rate hikes in this environment, given where inflation is. But here we are. So the June, look, I think we've all come to the realization that the June meeting is probably where they start. But it goes back to what Liz talks about all the time. Once they start, they're not going to stop. So if June is, in fact, in play, then we're probably on autopilot to the downside. And then one has to ask, although it would seemingly be constructive for risk assets, history suggests otherwise. So this again comes down to be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, I think your point, the autopilot term is a good one, because it's what kind of Fed Chair Powell was kind of tagged with, and maybe they used the expression themselves, probably not, but back in 2018, was it every other meeting they were kind of raising a quarter point, right? And so that was the autopilot thing, and it wasn't until stock market started selling off, growth fears kind of reared their head from around the world, and they kind of did an about face on those hikes. I wanted to mention this, and I think this is interesting, because you have been you've been steadfast on energy, and you've been talking about the space from a bunch of fundamental reasons. And you've been talking about the space, this goes back a year. And again, they had that huge run up into the kind of inflationary sort of period that we saw in early mid 2022. And then they came off kind of hard. There was a lot of global growth concerns. Look at this XLE. I mean, that's pretty impressive. We know that three names make up 40, 50% of it or so. OIH is also one that you've been pounding the table on. So I think it's interesting. Morgan Stanley upgrades the energy sector. And this is what I find fascinating. Mike Wilson, who's a good friend of ours, okay, so he's the head strategist over there. If you have been listening to Mike on the On the Tape podcast, he comes on every quarter with us, okay? He's been coming on Fast Money and the like here. He's been talking about energy. He's agreed with you on energy, okay? Now, he's gotten tagged with having the wrong S&P target, with being bearish on the S&P 500, okay? But under the surface, he's talked about a lot of different sectors. And this is not Mike just coming around to energy, right? Like, if you were listening to what he said, if you've been reading his notes, he's been bullish of energy. So talk to me a little bit about this guy, now here we are with the XLE back at 52-week highs, and we have, this sort of headline here. But again, Mike's been kind of very supportive of the energy trade for some time now.
Yeah, and I hope you have listened to him. And we have him on every quarter, and he hasn't really wavered on that. And compelling valuation in terms of the energy stocks is a phrase that we've used multiple times for many, many months, if not longer. And it's starting to play itself out. So just my opinion, in order for this to really move in a meaningful way, the energy, which it has in the midst of technology rallying. But if you see, for whatever reason, an exit out of these technology stocks, the rotation, in my opinion, is going to be in the energy names. And maybe we're starting to see a little bit of that now. I mean, maybe the weakness in Apple is manifesting itself in some of these energy stocks. I don't know. But again, if you see some of these bigger names start to give it up, I think the beneficiary of that are going to be energy stocks. And some of the names we've talked about, forgetting about the Exxon, Chevron's, and Conoco's, the Marathon Petroleum's, the PSX's, the Valero's. I mean, these are stocks that are not making 52-week highs. These are names that are making all-time highs. So there has been underlying strength in the industry without question. I think people will start to take notice. You mentioned the XLE correctly, because that's obviously the big one. If the XLE starts moving now in a meaningful way and the underlying three names start to really get on their horse, that's when people are going to start to take notice and say, wait a second, maybe energy is in play here.
Yeah, Again, and what does it have to do, dollar? You know, it's at the Dixie. Let's pull this up for a second here. 104.25. Mm-hmm. You know, this is kind of interesting because it's going the opposite way of the 10-year yield right now, which again, I think there's a bunch of stuff at play. We can spend some time talking about the weakness we're seeing in currencies, you know, in China and in Japan. And, you know, again, that's kind of above my pay grade. But when I just think of like, what are some of the sort of impediments to kind of growth? If you think about it, maybe a strong dollar is one of them, maybe higher, you know, like commodity costs and the like here. We're seeing sort of wage stuff all over the place, even on the low end or so. So again, this is the thing to me, guy. And I just like the Fed's job has gotten really hard here, like, because, you know, they got really dovish and it was odd. What were they thinking back in December? You know, because we talk about loosening financial conditions. Well, that rhetoric loosened financial conditions. It basically gave lots of investors in all different sorts of risk assets a whole host of reasons just to kind of just YOLO things. You know what I mean? And now here we are, some of the things that could be firming up and cause a pronounced slowdown at some point in the not so distant future. You know what I mean? Like, they're happening right in front of our eyes.
Well, that goes to, so I'm sort of implementing or integrating some of the questions into the answer to this question. Sure. So the Josephs are asking, thoughts on DBA. Now, DBA is an agriculture, I believe, ETF, 52-week high, inflation indication possible. So that's the question. Not only is it a 52-week high, I think at 24 and change, this is the highest level we've seen since 2015 or so. So very quietly, this has been getting on its horse. And it's probably, I don't know the components of it that intelligently, but I can say that, you know, cocoa, for those futures traders out there, today is a futures day. And Amanda, I don't know if you can pull up a cocoa chart. If you can't, I apologize, but this thing has been off to the races. And nobody talks about some of these soft commodities, but they've all been rallying. So to answer your question and using that question, yeah, look at that, Dan. That's a cocoa chart, by wow. The way. So, you know, you say what you want. I mean, this has implications as well for obviously some of the underlying components of the inflation thing we all monitor. So there you go. I mean, it's one thing for me to talk about it. It's another thing to look at it and see this.
Yeah, it's weird. Like, so at what point, it seems like, so if you're Bostic and you're some of these other guys in the Fed and gals, you know, like you're recognizing the fact that the inflation dragon's not slayed, but they seem very confident about getting down to their 2% target. You know what I'm saying? But yet the dots keep pushing out the cuts. You know what I'm saying? So, and I was thinking about this through the lens of like politics. You know, you hear a lot of folks talk about, well, you know, the Fed Chair Powell works for the president. The president wants to get, you know what I mean, reelected. I'm not sure Fed cuts, you know, like do the thing that helps the Biden administration, because where they're getting hurt on the economic message with unemployment where it is and you know, all that sort of stuff is inflation. It's what regular everyday Americans are paying, you know, to put food on their table, to heat their home, you know, all that sort of stuff. So again, I don't think rate cuts are that kind of, you know, political sort of, you know what I mean, like fairy dust that some people think.
Well, we're treading into areas that we probably shouldn't, but I'll say this. I mean, if asset prices were the thing that they're getting graded on, they do extraordinarily well when it came to the economy. But the reality is, and what they seemingly don't understand, it's got nothing to do with the stock market. It's got everything to do with what everyday Americans are dealing with every single day, and that's rising prices. So if they think somehow magically lowering rates is going to, you know, again, help them on the asset front, they don't need help on the asset front. They need help in other areas. And all that lowering rates is going to do is going to make what's the problem, which is inflation, that much worse. That's just my opinion. And I think, quite frankly, there's smart people that understand that, but it's also politically expedient to say, hey, higher rates are why you're hurting. That's got nothing to do with it, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, I get you. All right, here, guy, here's one for you. This is an interesting one. And I think I really like what he's doing here. Okay. This is from Gil Garcia. Guy, are you still hopeful on Palantir?
Oh, this see is, that? That's a nice a
CNBC,
job.
This is a CNBC that? Fast Money fan right here. So thank
that
you.
That is old school. Yeah. So my HOPE acronym, was that the first year we did it? I don't know. It might have been. Yeah. But the H in the HOPE was Home Depot. The O was Oracle. And the P was Palantir. And What I'll tell you is it didn't trade particularly well that year, but it's gotten on its horse. So pull up a longer-term Palantir chart, and you can see. So a lot of people believe that if data is the next oil, Palantir is sort of at the front end of this entire thing. And I think the problem with Palantir was, and continues to be to a certain extent, they're too reliant on government contracts. But if they can get some of these sort of, if they can start to move the needle away from government into some of these mid-size entities, I think that's when they can start, their margins can start to improve. And I think that's when they get the valuation they deserve. So the short answer is yes. And if you listen to, I think it's, what's his name? Carp. What's, I can't think of his name. Carp.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, if you listen Carp. To him speak,
Alex
he,
Carp.
He tells a great story in terms of what Palantir can be. So yes is the short answer.
All right, here's one. We got to hit this one because I really do think it's one of those things that is kind of contrary to some of the other stuff that's going on in the markets here, and it's about Bitcoin. So let's pull this up.
Is it contrary, though? But I'm glad you brought that up. So, yeah, bring it up.
Well, I mean, you know, it kind of feels like it. So this is JS. Thanks, Jay. Do the boys have any thoughts on BTC fund flows and specifically the fact that new ETFs don't trade all weekend while BTC does? Now, one thing I'll say is, Guy, I know that you spend lots of nights and you know, over the weekend and you're trading, you know, your spot Bitcoin, you know, because you can trade it because you're a junkie. You can trade 24/7. So the question specifically is, now that there's spot Bitcoin ETFs, you know what I mean? Like, you can walk in, right, on Monday morning, there can be kind of big gaps that, you know, are accounting for the activity that happened over the weekend. So when I look at this thing, though, I don't really, Guy, I'm sure you don't have much to say on the structure of these things.
I
don't either. But it is interesting that, let's talk about this. I don't know about you, man. More and more people that I know who 5 years ago thought this was just a fugazi, you know what I mean, are actually considering Bitcoin as a proper risk asset. And I also think that the spot Bitcoin ETFs being offered by some of the biggest brokerage firms and investment houses, you know what I mean, on the planet, kind of help the cause here. So it's not just retail being able to have access to this and put it in their IRA, that sort of thing. Obviously, institutions were waiting for this stamp of approval. So again, it's really volatile. But what does it speak to you that, again, the dollar's rallying today, yeah, and we're seeing a Bitcoin move like this, right, Guy?
Well, and that's why I sort of started this by saying maybe it's not as counterintuitive as you think, because, you know, again, and I don't want to go down this rabbit hole necessarily, but what we're seeing in terms of Japan, where they raised rates for the first time in 17 years, albeit at a very, you know, insignificant amount, but I think it speaks volumes as to what they need to do. And the fact that their yen actually weakened on the back of it is telling, I think. And, you know, we don't talk often about currency crises. I'm not suggesting we're on the precipice of one, but you got to watch dollar yen really closely. So I think the stronger the dollar gets against the yen, I think you're going to see continued. You could overlay a Bitcoin chart probably with a yen chart, and I bet you they're going to look eerily similar. I don't know that, and we could save it for another show. But I think what Bitcoin is telling you is, you know, wait a second. You know, these central banks got a bit of a problem on their hands, and it's manifesting itself the way Bitcoin is trading.
Fair enough. All right, one last question.
Oh, hold on. She's going to do this. Look at this. This is pretty unbelievable. Dude, hold on. I want to see if I'm
doing.
I'm actually curious myself if this is going to look similar. Anyway, sorry about that.
So here's one. This is from James Lundgren. And I'm reading this one. This is the last one. We got to go because you got to get your butt into the city. Great show, as always, guys. See, you gotta take that question, right, Guy? It just gives us.
Well, first of all, he smiles, which, yeah, I like happy people. Yeah. You notice I'm not a big smiler, but James is. So good for you.
You are a big spot. Can you speak to the crap that is running today, Atal, the DWAC, that's the SPAC that's going to merge with the Truth Social, and then GME, what's going on here? Well, GME reports earnings, I think it's tomorrow morning, or tomorrow after the close. Kind of washed out. I'm sure there's a lot of short interest. You guys know the drill, meme stock, you know, the like. There's still 23% of the float, Guy, of this is still short here. So again, that's probably what's going on there. And then with the DWAC, that just has to do with the fact that, you know, people are going to play games until this thing merges, which is supposedly going to start trading under DJT tomorrow. Again, this doesn't seem like a normal stock. So this is a $48 stock. It's up $11. Let's see how it starts trading. I mean, if every headline is that this is a windfall for former President Trump, And he's got obviously a lot of these financial obligations as it relates to, you know, this bond that just got reduced dramatically. I don't know if you saw the headline there. You know, the idea, the bunch of stuff, guy, that I read over the weekend is that this bails him out. Well, he can't actually do a thing with the shares for 6 months after the deal closes, which brings you to September. And listen, look at the history of a lot of these SPACs. They have a lot of goofy action until the trade happens, until it's consummated, and then they can just fall apart. You know what I mean? So it doesn't ensure that.
Yeah, unless the board gives some special dispensation that will. I mean, but I'll say this: if you want to get a good primer as to what's going on, I think Karen broke down DWAC last week, and in terms of what it's rolling into, how the current price based on the revenues and based on what she's looking at and based on the projections that they're not making makes absolutely no sense. So I might've been Friday, and I apologize if I'm off by a day, but I think it was Friday's Fast Money that Karen went into detail about this. Maybe we can put that in the show. I don't know.
Yeah, no, they can find it. They'll find it.
Yeah. That video, I think
Karen will help. Fast Money DWAC. It'll come up kind of quickly. Yeah. So she did her guy. Don't we call that her finer print?
Feinerman's finer prints. Yes.
There you go. All right. Well, the last thing I'll just say, and I'd say this about any meme stock. Okay. Like, that is obviously a meme stock. And if there was ever a stock that there was going to be shenanigans with, it would probably be that one. So again, you better have your finger on the trigger there, guy, if you're going to play in that one.
Absolutely. And that's it. The Rangers do not play tonight. I was there Saturday night in a game that they were losing 2-0, in a game that they came back and tied. And then in a game, they were down 3-2 with 4 minutes left. They scored shortly thereafter. Win in a shootout with now the best record in the National Hockey League. I believe they play tomorrow, and Dan's going, aren't you?
I am going. Yeah, no, I am going. I'm glad you got to see a shootout. I mean, like, you know, I'm glad.
That's bullshit. I don't like the skills. I'm not an advocate of the hockey purists out there are not fans of the skills competition that decides games.
It's kind of fun, though. All right.
Let's put it this way. If an NBA game ended in a tie, we got to get out of here. Would you want it decided by the two best three-point shooters on the team, seeing who makes the most out of 10? It's dopey.
It is dopey. But again,
let them finish it on the arena they play, whether it's the hard court of a basketball or the ice of a hockey rink.
All right. So just, you were in the world's most famous arena for that game, right? What do you think is the most famous multiple overtime game that has ever?
Pete Stemkowski.
All right. Well, I was going to say
it was Stefan Matteau. I know what you were going to say.
Oh, no, it was Matteau, game 7, double overtime against the Devils in 1994 to send them to the Stanley Cup Finals. That's all right. That's the most famous hockey one. Aside from that, Syracuse-UConn. You remember that one in the Big East tournament? 6 overtimes.
Actually, now that you say it, it rings a bit of a bell.
6 overtimes.
Yeah. And isn't that better?
Yeah.
I mean, that's far more memorable than deciding the end of a regulation game by a 3-point shooting competition. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes. Jacob will put that one in the show notes. If you have not seen the highlights of that game, it is one of the sickest things. I think it went like an extra hour, guy, like after the regulation. So, all right, we'll leave it at that.
That was fun. All right, tomorrow we're back. Tomorrow's Tuesday. I think the great is, if I'm not mistaken,
Carter Braxton-Worth. He is back.
Carter Braxton-Worth will be back tomorrow. Wednesday is EY from SoFi. Thursday, if it's Thursday,
it's Butter.
Bitch, yes.
All right, just really quickly, and I just want to clarify this. I got an email from somebody, a regular watcher. He doesn't love that, but he doesn't think. But the problem is, I'm just going.
What doesn't he love?
Hold on. He thinks you're denigrating him. You're not denigrating him. What's going on?
Are you kidding me?
It's a Britney Spears song, right? And it's Britney, bitch. You are giving him the highest praise that you could. I just want to make that really
crystal clear. His work is, unparalleled.
You are not one to denigrate.
Let me put it this way. If he was a Johnson, I wouldn't be saying it, right? It's like if somebody is really in shape and you call him or her, you know, like rotund man or something, it's obvious that they're not.
Yes.
Right? Or somebody that's 6'3", calling him or her shorty. I mean.
Yeah.
You follow?
Slim is another one.
Like Doyle Lonergan in this thing. You follow?
Yeah. By the way, my dad was a little chunky guy. He played football. And then when he went to play lacrosse, this was in college, He was on what they called the fat boy midfield. Okay. So he had never seen a lacrosse stick in his life, and they put one in his hand and they just sent him out there just to be a bruiser. Okay. So, and his nickname was Slim. So it's the opposite of what you're talking about in a way, right? Like, so, you know, but that's meant to be funny. And I'm sure Steve Nathan appreciated it because he was just one of the guys.
Yeah. And I listen, again, people get all twisted about things. I get it. That's the world we live in. You know what?
I just want to explain that.
If it's Thursday, Dan,
it's Butters.
Bitch. We'll see you folks tomorrow. See you later.